hundreds and thousands of people are going to lose their homes. They will die.
Let's be honest, for a cruel and desperate hope of maximizing profits.
Stop evictions at all costs.
They brought living room furniture into the streets, saying this is what the city would look like as thousands face eviction. Their demand, cancel the rent.
A lot of folks have had to choose whether to eat or to pay rent.
The federal government and many cities and states have enacted a series of temporary measures halting residential evictions in the United States.
Evictions were leading to unnecessary cases of COVID and unnecessary deaths from COVID.
Dubbed the tenant movement's giant killer by One Industry Trade magazine, Sia Weaver is a rising star in New York politics.
So this is life-saving, and that's the most important thing.
The cancel rent movement, Weaver told the New York Times, is also about literally rising up for real transformation in the housing market. In New York, that transformation is underway, and it's having a devastating impact on landlords. The eviction moratorium isn't just benefiting the poor. It's allowing bad actors to stop paying their rent without consequence. Meanwhile, many small landlords are seeing their life savings disappear, because they have no choice but to maintain their buildings at a loss.
我们就想投资点房地产，就是赚点，就是说配这个mortgage，就是生活过得更好一点，这是大家的所有人的共同的心愿。
One landlord who's been hurt by the eviction moratorium is Chow Huai Gao, who works at a nail salon and saved for 20 years to buy a house in Queens. In March of last year, a squatter moved in. This person, who didn't respond to our interview request, is a dropout from an elite private university, and he has never paid rent. Because of the eviction moratorium, there's no legal mechanism through which Gao can retake possession of his property. Meanwhile, his bills are mounting.
No pay rent, I'm so angry. It's a robbery. Maybe I tell you how to say it.
People don't usually joke about jumping off.
No joke. I no money. 你说我辛苦了二十多年，我这么大才有这个姑娘。
So in my story, one landlord says this is really a straightforward issue. It's robbery. He's paying heat taxes and a mortgage, so someone else is living rent free, and he has absolutely no recourse. Do you agree with that characterization? Is this robbery?
No, I don't think it's robbery. And we're also not saying that the landlord can never collect the rent. That's not what an eviction moratorium does. It's simply a pause. So. No, I don't agree with that. I think it's deeply misleading.
But practically speaking, this landlord will be very lucky. I mean, just the way housing court runs, if he is able to collect back rent in terms of the cost of hiring lawyers, the delays that come in housing court.
You don't have to be in the business of being a landlord. Those are part of the costs of being a landlord. That should be understood as part of the deal. And it is.
But owners say having almost no legal recourse when their tenants don't pay their rent is not something they consider to be part of the deal when investing in real estate. Landlord groups around the country have sued on the grounds that halting the judicial process that allows them to retake their property violates their due process rights, and that the national moratorium is an unconstitutional expansion of federal power. Gao is part of an association of about 200 Chinese immigrant landlords with tenants who have stopped paying rent.
我在美国我做工做了整整做了二十九年，我没有像我的腰，你看我的腰都做了要动手术了，你我的房子都卖不出去了，哪有这样子？美国哪有去出这种的情况啊？你还叫我怎么活下去啊？
This landlord worked as a housekeeper at a hotel that recently closed down. She says her tenants stopped paying rent over the summer and is demanding a $12,000 cash payment to move out.
因为我的现在腰痛了，还有没工作，真的，我真的有一种很大压力。我都得了抑郁症，我每天晚上都睡不着。你看我的眼圈黑的，我真的晚上都睡不着，我都不知道怎么活下去。I
think it's really critical that mom and pop landlords are prioritized for aid right now. At the same time, everyone has taken a haircut. They don't have a God-given right to collect rent, just like hotels don't have a God-given right to profit off of the tourism industry, and bars and restaurants don't have a God-given right to like serve people dinner and wine, you know?
When do we want it? No! We don't get it! We don't get it!
Weaver says she feels for these landlords, but tenants are worse off.
And we know as a matter of statistical fact that renters are far less likely to have wealth and renters are far less likely to have anything in saving. Well, I know that there's some examples like the ones that you're raising and, you know, for and I feel for that person and want them to get the resources that they need from the state.
The media has predicted a huge wave of evictions in the United States if the moratoriums are lifted. And in New York, tenant activists dragged furniture out into the streets to dramatize the potential impact. But in New York, before COVID, only about 1 out of 10 eviction filings ended in a city marshal or sheriff physically removing a tenant from a dwelling. However, because there existed a process through which landlords could enforce their contracts and get tenants who weren't paying their rent to come to the negotiating table or move out, they had legal recourse. One problem with the eviction moratorium is that in practice, it's not only impacting those in need, it's also allowing tenants who can afford their rent to take advantage of their landlords.
You can pay, you can live here. You can pay money, and then you find the apartment, move out.
Juan, who asked that we only use her last name, owns a house in Queens and works as a home health aide, caring for an elderly couple. Her husband is a waiter at this restaurant in Chinatown, though he's barely been able to work since the pandemic. She says that her tenant owes her more than $80,000 in back rent.
Every month I need to pay the money. Where have the money can pay? I only the way I keep walking. But I just want the government open the court.
Juan says that if her tenants were unemployed or financially distressed, she'd be willing to work with them.
These people no money, I can help for all. Okay, pay later or something. But these people no, the people have money.
Reason wasn't able to reach her tenants for comment, so we're not using their names in this story. But we did find that the father, who has a criminal record, is currently employed in the construction industry. And while his girlfriend's mother and children live in Juan's apartment, he and his girlfriend are renting a second apartment in this house in Queens Village, where they've also stopped paying rent and owe $12,000 to the couple that owns the house, who are also Chinese immigrants. But it's not only immigrant landlords who are being taken advantage of. Sharon Redhead, who's the owner of a building in Brooklyn, told the New York Daily News that some of her tenants who are out of work have kept up with their rent, while others with jobs aren't paying any rent at all. Clarence Hammer is the owner of a two-family home with a tenant who isn't paying rent but is subletting rooms at a profit. The New York Post told the story of 88-year-old Harlem landlord David Housen, suffering from Alzheimer's, with a tenant who hasn't paid a dime since 2016. "We're completely destitute," his daughter told the Post.
The idea that there's a handful of renters who are maybe working and saying like, oh, I have the money and I'm just not gonna pay right now. All of the data is showing that that's an aberration. The data that shows people who are borrowing to pay rent, the data that shows that people, that renters, 48% of renters are behind on their housing costs compared to 6% of property owners who are behind on their housing costs. Like, the data is just with us.
Weaver is referring to census data that doesn't single out landlords, but that does show that renters are more financially distressed than people who own their own homes. And newspapers have recounted the stories of many tenants in crisis, such as Dibba Gay, whose wife recently died of heart disease and who lost his job stocking groceries. "I don't want to lose my house too," he told the Times. And Halima Abdul Wahab, who says she and her two children are at risk of homelessness. "I'm at a job where I don't make that much, but I just try to maintain as much as I can," she said. Rent is not the only thing that has to be paid every month. But these individuals can be helped with the type of direct aid that the government has been providing since the early days of the pandemic, through interest-free loans, stimulus checks, and a substantial increase in unemployment benefits. Cities and states have also spent billions in federal money on rent relief programs. These programs bring their own set of problems and trade-offs, and those funded by philanthropy have proven more effective than government-financed ones. But if tenants are receiving the aid they need, owners should still be able to turn to the courts if they don't pay their rent. Weaver says this approach fails to help populations that are hard to reach with direct aid, like undocumented immigrants. Her organization helped to draft a proposed state law under which the government would cover missing rent, no matter the reason tenants hadn't paid, and with strings attached for landlords who accept the money.
Because we think it'll get the money out the fastest, right? The landlords have rent ledgers, they have operating statements, they have rent rolls.
But there's another reason Weaver and her political allies want to make landlords dependent on federal subsidies. Emergency policies enacted in times of crisis are prone to becoming permanent, which some members of the cancel rent movement say is the goal.
We need to think about the role that exclusion and profit, which are the sort of characteristics of the private property market, have played, and think about different systems and structures that we could put into place that would help more people be housed.
Weaver would like to see the entire real estate industry restructured in a model akin to public housing, but for rich people too.
In public housing, people are paying 30% of their income. What I am envisioning is a world in which the housing is owned by a collective and people are paying 30% of their income in order to live in their housing. If your income is zero, you pay zero. If your income is $500,000 a year, you're paying 30% of that. And the government is providing the sort of, the government is the sort of owner, or not even the owner, the government doesn't have to be the owner, but the government is what's making sure all of that sort of works in cash flows.
The debt to GDP ratio right now is the highest since World War II. Trump left us with an additional $7.8 trillion in debt, and Biden's agenda would add $11 trillion on top of what we're already spending over the next 10 years. So how can the federal government also afford to start subsidizing rental housing costs?
The federal government prints money. The federal government can provide money for those.
So it's by printing money.
Sure.
America is beautiful. Nobody pays rent. This is not beautiful, okay? This is ugly.
Gao, his wife, and two daughters are living in a one-room studio, unable to move into the building they own. And they're afraid to contact the person squatting there, out of fear that they'll be sued for harassment. When Gao and other immigrant landlords decided to come to the United States to create a better life, this is not the American dream they thought they were buying into.
Bitcoin has won over some of America's best-known billionaires, and institutions worldwide are treating it as a serious financial asset. But price is only one part of the story. Whether they know it or not, people who buy Bitcoin are strengthening a tool for protecting human rights. This still relatively new form of electronic money is censorship-resistant, seizure-resistant, borderless, permissionless, pseudonymous, programmable, and peer-to-peer. In Bitcoin, transactions don't go through banks or financial intermediaries. They travel directly from one person to another. Payment processing is done not by a regulated company like Visa or MasterCard, but by a decentralized global software network. Storage is handled not by a bank, but by the users themselves. Bitcoin issuance isn't determined by central bankers. The currency's creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, set it to have an ultimate limit of 21 million. No one can ever print more. Bitcoin transactions can't be stopped, and you don't need to reveal your name or address or telephone number to participate. You just need internet access. In 2017, the economist Paul Krugman described Bitcoin as some fancy technological thing that nobody really understands. There's been no demonstration yet that it actually is helpful in conducting economic transactions. There's no anchor for its value. Krugman lives in a sheltered environment in a liberal democracy with constitutional protections. His native currency is globally dominant and relatively stable. It's easy for him to open a bank account, to use a mobile app to pay bills, or to grow his wealth by investing in real estate or stocks. But most people don't have the same privilege. 4.2 billion live under authoritarian regimes that use money as a tool for surveillance and state control. Their currency is often debased, and they are for the most part cut off from the international system that Krugman enjoys. For them, saving and transacting outside the government's purview isn't shady business, it's a way to preserve their freedoms. In China, if you type or utter one wrong word, the Communist Party might eliminate your financial services. This devastating outcome creates a chilling effect for dissidents and creative minds who are forced to use the country's increasingly centralized digital economy. In Hong Kong or Russia, donors to human rights organizations can get their bank accounts suspended and funds seized. Over the past few months in Belarus and Nigeria, nationwide protests have broken out against tyranny and corruption. In both places, activists raising money to support the democracy movement have had their bank accounts frozen. And as we saw in Burma just a few days ago, the military shut down the banking system during their latest coup and turned off the ATMs. For activists living under state repression, Bitcoin provides a way to preserve their money in cyberspace, locked away by encryption, safe from devaluation, in a network that has never been hacked. For them, it's digital cash and digital gold rolled into one. And in Cuba, Nigeria, China, Pakistan, Venezuela, Russia, Turkey, Argentina, Palestine, Zimbabwe, and elsewhere, Bitcoin is catching on and helping people escape tyranny and currency collapse. In the past few months, Belarusian activists have used Bitcoin to defy the regime by sending more than $3 million of unstoppable money directly to striking workers, who then convert it locally to rubles in peer-to-peer marketplaces to feed their families as they protest the country's dictatorship. In October, a feminist coalition in Nigeria raised the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars in Bitcoin to buy gas masks and protest equipment as activist bank accounts were being turned on and off. In Russia, the politician and activist Alexei Navalny has raised millions in Bitcoin in opposition to Vladimir Putin, who has strict control over the traditional financial system. Putin can do a lot of things, but he can't freeze a Bitcoin account. In Iran and Palestine and Cuba, citizens are increasingly able to escape foreign restrictions on their financial rights, thanks to Bitcoin. In these places, individuals are dealing with sanctions or embargoes placed on them because of the misdeeds of their corrupt rulers. Bitcoin gives them a lifeline for earning income or receiving remittances from abroad. Some Venezuelans, having watched their country's currency evaporate due to hyperinflation, are converting their time and energy and family resources to Bitcoin's digital format and then escaping. With their savings secured by a password that can be stored on a flash drive, phone, or even memorized, they've started new lives in other countries, taking advantage of a technology that refugees throughout history could only dream about. The citizens of democracies also face financial controls, deplatforming, and an ever-expanding surveillance state. But those lucky enough to live in open societies can vote, sue, protest, and write, and those methods might allow them to protect their financial freedom and privacy. The billions who live under authoritarian governments don't have the same options. Unlike democracy, Bitcoin is universally available. You don't need to have a particular passport or bank card or voting status to use it. No government can turn off your Bitcoin if it's threatened by your ideas. We are in the middle of a great digital transformation, a time when cash, one of the last bastions of privacy and freedom, is disappearing. People are increasingly relying on easily surveilled apps like Apple Pay, Alipay, and perhaps soon central bank digital currencies as their primary medium of exchange. Bitcoin provides an alternative to our increasingly centralized financial system. It gives any activist or journalist a way to raise funds without censorship, a way to save despite the corrosive impact of excessive money printing, and a way to teleport value without permission. Bitcoin wasn't as powerful 5 years ago, before it had global liquidity. But today, exchanges have popped up in every region, daily trading volume exceeds that of popular stocks like Apple, and peer-to-peer marketplaces like Paxful and Local Bitcoins have extended their reach, enabling users to sell Bitcoin for local currency almost anywhere in the world. Maybe you don't need Bitcoin, and maybe you don't understand Bitcoin, and maybe PayPal, Venmo, or your bank account serve your needs just fine. But don't write off Bitcoin as simply a vehicle for financial speculation. For millions of people around the world, it's an escape hatch from tyranny, and nothing less than freedom money.
Power and government power, which is really characteristic of Italian fascism in the 20s, and they're using that to engage in kind of emergency orders that simply strip us of our rights, rights to property, rights to assembly, rights to worship, and all of the rights that our Constitution guarantees. So people are definitely horrified and noticing. I think people are shocked and divided, as I mentioned before. And the other thing that happened is you said this has all been very sudden. And when you look back, you know, March of 2020, a lot of things started to move that kind of locked into place a set of policies that are kind of 360-degree full-on totalitarian policies. So I think a lot of us are kind of in culture shock. Luckily or unluckily, I've been studying closing democracies for 12 years. So I recognized early on, you know, once I realized New York State had emergency powers, I know from history that no one gives up emergency powers willingly. They always drag it on and drag it on. And so every month I'm getting in my email an announcement that Governor Cuomo is extending emergency measures. Only from studying history do I know how predictable it is when you start to have elected officials say we are not going to follow the Constitution because there's a pandemic. And I just want to say lastly, and then I promise I'll stop, nowhere in the Constitution does it say all this can be suspended if there's a bad disease. We have lived through typhus, cholera, smallpox, HIV, tuberculosis, polio, the Spanish flu. You know, we've lived through an attack on our soil. Never have there been months and months and months of emergency powers when we weren't actually fighting a war. So this is completely unprecedented. Lockdowns have never been done before in free societies. And really, we're turning into a version of a totalitarian state sort of before everyone's eyes. And I really hope, you know, we wake up quickly, because history also shows that it's a small window in which people can fight back before it's too dangerous to fight back.
Man, I'm starting to think that we're being divided as a country precisely so we don't have conversations like this. And I hope you will come.
great moments and unintended consequences. Part 1. Osborne Reef. The year is 1972. The problem? Too many old tires piling up in landfills. The solution? Dump over 2 million of them off the coast of Florida to create an artificial reef for marine life. Sounds like a great idea. With the best of intentions, what could possibly go wrong? It turns out tires are round, and they roll, becoming uncontrollable wrecking balls that destroy the natural coral nearby. Some scientists believe the rubber is also leaking toxins into the environment. One thing is for sure, cleaning up this mess will take years, cost millions of dollars, and even require help from the military. Part 2. Corn ethanol subsidies. Word got out. Corn ethanol is cheaper, cleaner, renewable, and it will reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Soon after, along came legislation to subsidize it and mandate its consumption. Sounds like a great idea. With the best of intentions, what could possibly go wrong? So many things. Soil erosion, widespread deforestation, rising food prices, rising gas prices, massive water requirements, pollution from fertilizer and pesticides, and the fact that throughout the entire production cycle, ethanol produces more greenhouse gases than regular gasoline. And according to scientists at Cornell University and the University of California, making 1 gallon of corn ethanol requires 1.29 gallons of fossil fuel. All this at a cost of $7 billion a year. Even Al Gore recently admitted the subsidies were a mistake. Part 3. Legislation that requires health insurance companies which offer child-only policies to accept all children regardless of pre-existing medical conditions. Sounds like a great idea! With the best of intentions, what could possibly go wrong? The real problem here is that medical care costs money. This sort of legislation encourages people to hold off on paying for health insurance until it's needed, driving up premiums for all customers, who are in turn encouraged to drop their coverage. Now you have an adverse selection death spiral, with results that are just as bad as that sounds. So instead of committing economic suicide, those companies completely stop issuing child-only policies, and now even healthy children can't get coverage, which might be funny if it wasn't just sad. This has been Great Moments in Unintended Consequences. Good intentions, bad results.
And now, Great Moments in Unintended Consequences. Part 1, The Yacht Plot. The year, 1990. The problem? A national debt that had exploded. The solution? A 10% luxury tax on expensive boats. Sounds like a great idea. With the best of intentions, what could possibly go wrong? It turns out that while wealthy people buy yachts, it's usually middle-income people who make them. This giant middle finger of a tax plan cut sales of luxury boats by 70%, sent companies overseas or into Chapter 11, destroyed hundreds of thousands of middle-class jobs, and resulted in a net loss in tax revenue. Turns out it was all for yacht. Part 2. Who's Hungry Mao? The year is 1958. The problem? Birds eating too much grain in China. The solution? Chairman Mao labels the Eurasian sparrow as a capitalist enemy of the state, kicking off a nationwide campaign to eradicate the species. Sounds like an idea! With the best of intentions, what could possibly go wrong? It turns out sparrows also eat insects, and insects eat a lot more grain than sparrows do. 100 million dead birds later, grain yields plummeted in China, resulting in massive famine, starvation, and deaths estimated between 15 and 45 million people. On the bright side, at least China learned its lesson about rounding up unwanted population. Part 3. Vaccination proclamations. The year 2021. The problem? Effective distribution for a vaccine with a short shelf life. New York solution? Create a massively detailed yet questionable priority schedule, then mandate appointments, pushing applicants, including the elderly, toward a buggy website to answer lengthy questionnaires and upload multiple attachments. When that slows things down, find distribution centers for giving about to expire doses to non-priority patients. When they throw expired doses away, fine them for not using their entire supply fast enough. Also, remove the priority status of frontline workers who don't get it early enough and threaten to strip medical licenses and future vaccine delivery for those who don't comply with all the rules created and changed on a daily basis. Sounds like... Come on, New York, get it together. Just don't forget to cover up nursing home deaths and blame the federal government when you collect your Emmy. Great moments in unintended consequences. Good intentions, bad results.
Submitted for your approval, a relatively free and prosperous republic marred by Marxian and Leninist revolution masquerading as a struggle for racial justice and national liberation. Today we examine South Africa's twilight from freedom to tyranny. This is Anarchy in America with Christian Gomez. I'm pleased to have Alex Newman, the foreign correspondent of the New American Magazine, with us here today. Alex, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you, Christian.
So, Alex, you've been covering South Africa for years now, close to 10 years in the New American at least, possibly even more than that. But most Americans probably don't know that what's happening right now in America, it's already happened and is happening to a greater degree in South Africa. So can you tell us how South Africa went from being this prosperous nation in the 1980s, very similar to the United States, not exactly, but very similar, to being in the situation that it's in today? A little bit of the background there.
Well, the long and the short of it is it was taken over by communists and totalitarians backed by what the average American today, 75% of Americans, recognize as the deep state, the power elites, the shadow government behind the scenes. And they used tactics and strategies very similar to what they're using in the United States right now. Always communist strategy involves deception. It involves taking real and imagined grievances, and there were real grievances in South Africa, that's not to say that there weren't, taking those, weaponizing them, and using them to drive a wedge between people and to advance their objectives. And so we're seeing almost a replica of the revolution that took place in South Africa in America, with some distinctions. You know, the communists have always recognized that different nations, well, I shouldn't say always, because Marx didn't necessarily recognize this, but after the Soviet Union, they tried in Western Europe with their revolutions, and they realized it wouldn't work the same way that it did in Russia. So they realized they needed to come up with different strategies depending on what nation they were working in. In South Africa, the obvious issue to seize on was race.
Apartheid, right?
Exactly, yep. And so they seized on that issue, and they basically said, your options are racism and apartheid or communism. And they didn't say communism. They said national democratic revolution and
self-determination, right. National liberation, all the euphemisms that the communists
democracy,
have used.
Freedom, peace, you know, all the same deceptive terms that don't mean what you think they mean when communists say them. And, you know, the rest is history. Now South Africa has entered what they call the second phase of the National Democratic Revolution, where they really dropped the mask. And they say, hey, now we're just going to take your stuff. We're going to take your businesses. We're going to take your farms. We are going to, as they put it, take control of the key commanding heights of the economy, by which they just mean, you know, now is the forced expropriation of property. Now the, as they call it, the radical second phase of the revolution comes about. Because, you know, they had to convince the voters of South Africa to relinquish power and bring in this new regime.
And how exactly did they do that? So here in the U.S., we see a lot of white guilt used to get white people to be out in the streets and protesting for the Black Lives Matter cause. In fact, if you look at a lot of photographs of the Black Lives Matter protests, you see a lot of white people, a lot of white women protesting with the signs, white silence is
violence.
Is violence, exactly. So is that what happened in South Africa? That, you know, how did the ANC, the African National Congress, come to power when they had no power in the 80s and were considered a terrorist organization?
Yeah, that's very similar to what they did, Christian. They, the ANC, first of all, needs to be understood as an arm of the Soviet Union. Now, it didn't start that way. It was gradually taken over. But they used this racial tension that existed. I guess first you need to kind of explain what the apartheid system was, because you know it's gotten so blown out of proportion now that you have people who actually think it was like Nazism or something. It wasn't a nice system, but essentially it had something in common with the American system of Indian reservations. You had Dutch immigrants who started arriving in the Cape in the 1640s, and they came from a Western Christian society. And so they built a Western Christian society on the Cape of South Africa. Now, there was no black people around at that time on the Western Cape. They were, you know, over 100 miles into the interior. And so what happened was they set up kind of parallel civilizations. And what happened under apartheid, the British government actually laid the foundations for this. They said, you know, there's a lot of different people groups.
When you say the British government, you mean the British government in the UK, not
the Imperial British government. Okay. Yeah, they were managing the region of southern Africa. And the Boers had their own little republics for a time.
The
Afrikaners, the Dutch who speak Afrikaans. And Boer just means farmer. So they were kind of Dutch, descendant of Dutch, Scandinavian, German, Lutheran, Belgians.
So essentially the white people in South Africa of British and Dutch.
Not necessarily British. The British and the descendants of the Dutch have often been at odds. Now, depending on who you talk to in South Africa, some will include the British among Afrikaners, because Afrikaner is just kind of like Americaner is what the Dutch would call Americans who immigrated to America. But there is that distinction. And so the British imperial government, they kind of set up this, where they laid the foundations to set up this system where each people group was given its own homeland. And that's what apartheid essentially was. So you had different, they called them homelands for the different people groups. And some of those still exist today as independent nations. Lesotho is the homeland for the Zoto people, and they have their own king. They're independent from South Africa. They're not part of the unitary state that is South Africa. Same thing with Botswana. It's the home of the Tswana people. Same thing with Swaziland. It's the home of the Swazi people. You had Zululand, which of course was absorbed into the unitary state that is South Africa, with a lot of opposition, by the way. The Zulus were incredibly hostile to the communist takeover. And in fact, there was multiple instances throughout South African history where the Zulus and the Afrikaners allied, including for a time against the communist takeover. But what the ANC did was essentially backed by the deep state in the West, by the Rockefellers, by the Council on
State
Foreign
Department
Relations,
as well.
By the U.S. State Department. I mean, the U.S. State Department was pouring money into these subversive groups, going clear back to, you know, 1950s even. And they basically tried to create the impression that they were these moderate Democrats and, you know, we just want to end the system of...
that they're not communists like they did with Fidel Castro in
absolutely,
Cuba.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, they tried to sell that. And, you know, nobody really believed it. I mean, Nelson Mandela and the ANC were put on our list of terrorist organizations here in the United States.
By the way, this Nelson Mandela...
Right, standing there with Joe Slovo.
With the leader of the Communist Party of South Africa, Joe Slovo, and the... doing the communist salute there with the hammer and sickle behind them.
Yeah. And it's incidentally, after Nelson Mandela died, both the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress not only admitted that he was a Central Committee member of the Communist Party of South Africa, they bragged about it. And of course, Nelson Mandela lied about that whole life.
And of course, the ANC, as you've mentioned in many of your reports, is actually controlled and led by the South African Communist Party. And before we started this interview, you mentioned an early draft that was leaked about of Nelson Mandela's autobiography. Can you tell us a little bit about that and sort of communist connections in that draft?
Yeah, that was interesting too. So we did get a leaked version of Nelson Mandela's original autobiography, and it openly promotes communism. It openly praises Fidel Castro. It openly advocates violence as a tool for achieving communist revolution. And I mean, that's right in line with what Mandela would go on to do. He was actually the leader of the MK, which was the terrorist wing of the ANC, what they call it the armed struggle wing. And so these people were setting roadside bombs. They were blowing up nightclubs and shopping malls.
And all this was done to intimidate the people, divide the population, but of course to neutralize the opposition.
Precisely.
And can you focus a little bit about how the ANC, Mandela, and the SACP, the South African Communist Party, how they neutralized the opposition to silence the sort of the status quo that existed before, to accepting the ANC's, you know, and communist rule since 1994 onwards?
Yeah, so they actually, you know, the apartheid government could have probably lasted indefinitely, even with global sanctions. The U.S. government imposed sanctions. The United Nations imposed sanctions. The Soviets were big on sanctions. So they had basically isolated South Africa to the point where it was a global pariah. Yet the South African people, they had created everything they needed. They had nuclear power. They had their own weapons factories. I mean, some of the most advanced weapons ever were being produced there. Incredibly good military hardware. Their military was second to none. But the international pressure got so much, the South African people were kind of told that you're a pariah, everybody hates you. The only way you can undo this is by surrendering power and allowing this new system to come in. And so, you know, again, there was serious problems with apartheid. There was, you know, a system of you had to have internal passports if you wanted to go from the homeland into a different area of the country. So it was almost like these independent countries, and they had, you know, strict regulations for people of one race working in an area of other races. And so, you know, it was kind of strange. But when people look at South Africa and they think of it as a nation, they're fundamentally misunderstanding what South Africa is. It's many nations who happen to occupy the tip of Southern Africa.
Like the United States.
Right.
A melting pot of many different cultures and ethnicities.
Well, South Africa wasn't so much a melting pot. These people kept their—I mean, the Zulu people, they still speak their language.
They kept their autonomous
right.
cultures.
Yeah, and I mean, they still have their old tribal leaders, although they don't have much power under the ANC system now.
But the ANC has tried to destroy those traditional cultures and just create this new sort of black power, black identity
right.
that's against the Boers and white farmers and white people in general.
That's right. So it's a unitary state now, and public, you know, the communists always need an enemy, and now the enemy is they call it white monopoly capital is the term that they use. And they're not really against, quote, white monopoly capital. They're not talking about the Rockefellers. They're not talking about the Rothschilds. They're not talking about George Soros. They're talking about the farmer who maybe's got a couple hundred or a couple thousand hectares that he's, you know, eking out a living under these
crazy
oppressive taxes.
That they claim was stolen
taxes.
From them when, in fact, those lands, as you mentioned earlier, when the Dutch and then later when the British came, those lands were not inhabited before. They were uninhabited
on the
lands.
Western Cape. That's right. Yeah. They had the Hottentot people, and they had a good relationship with them for a long time. But you know, and different parts of South Africa, the land was acquired in different ways. One of the really interesting stories that I think is so fascinating about the history of South Africa is when the Voer trekkers, the Afrikaners who trekked to the interior of the country to try to escape British oppression, met with the Zulus. And there was a Zulu king called Dingane, or Dingaan, depending on what pronunciation you use. And this guy was absolutely monstrous. He was one of several rival Zulu kings to the throne. And so he told the Voer trekkers, hey, if you guys get me back my cows from another tribal leader, I will give you a grant to all this land. And you guys can settle and you can have farms. You can do whatever you want. So they did. They got back the cows. They brought them to him. And instead of upholding his part of the deal and giving them that land that he had promised, he had them all impaled, including wow. children. And pretty unbelievable. And so then the surviving Voer trekkers went back and they regrouped. They actually allied with another group of Zulus with a different rival.
And took the land
king.
That was promised to them.
Yeah, and then they went back and they defeated King Dingane. So
So there's a really long, complicated history there.
It's
incredibly
complicated.
It's not the black and white picture that we're, so to speak, that's presented by the media, especially in South Africa. Oh, white man came, stole our land. Now we got to kill the farmers like the leader of the EFF with the...
Julius Malema, yeah, who used to be the leader of the ANC Youth League.
Yes, which is a militant communist organization in South Africa. And he's one of the leading voices of this whole the black man got to take over the white man's kind of land rhetoric that's being used in South Africa. Now, going back to how things are in the United States, we have the whole Black Lives Matter revolutions going on in the streets against the, you know, against police officers and against capitalism, if you're looking at their signs. How does this relate to what's happening in South Africa now and then? For example, we're seeing the statues being toppled in the United States of not just Confederate monuments, Confederate soldiers, Confederate generals like Robert E. Lee, who, by the way, was a great Christian person. Never mind that. But we're seeing statues of Abraham Lincoln, even the name Woodrow Wilson being taken down from Princeton University. Not that he's a saint. He certainly isn't. But all these historical figures that are white, not black. How does that relate to what's happening in South Africa today? Is that same pattern occurring there as well?
That same exact pattern is occurring. And so, you know, as we started off earlier in the program, we talked about different strategies for taking over different nations. in America and also in South Africa, trying to use class warfare was much more difficult. America is so incredibly prosperous that, you know, to try to tell poor Americans that they're oppressed and that they need a revolution to steal other people's wealth, it's just not a reasonable selling point. Your poor person in America has, you know, two cars in the driveway. They've got multiple color TVs. They've got iPhones. They've got internet. They've got cable. They've got air conditioning. They've got more living space than your average middle class European. So to tell them, oh, you're poor and oppressed, it's like, nah, no, that doesn't really work. And the same thing was true in South Africa. South Africa was far and away the most prosperous nation on the entire continent of Africa. I mean, there wasn't even a close second.
So even under apartheid, black South Africans had a higher standard of living than
anywhere else on the continent.
You know, liberated black nations that were essentially already, you know, Soviet puppet states throughout Africa.
Millions of black immigrants were pouring into apartheid South Africa. So, you know, again, this notion that it was like Nazi Germany is absolutely ludicrous. Millions of African
just
immigrants.
Like in the United States. You know, the U.S. is this evil, racist, imperialist country.
And yet everyone wants to be here.
Everyone wants to be here, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, they demonized South Africa so much, and I think it's along with Rhodesia, which also has been similarly demonized, Rhodesia and South Africa probably had the best, you know, I shouldn't say probably, definitely had the best human rights record of any government on the entire continent. No question about it.
And for those watching, Rhodesia is now Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe, yeah. So we saw how well that communist revolution there worked out. Again, help from the same people, Henry Kissinger, Jimmy Carter. They could not stand the idea of Ian Smith, the leader of Rhodesia, who declared independence from the British Empire. Not because he wanted to. I mean, he considered himself a loyal subject of the Queen, but he was forced into it because they basically said, you know, you will either accept communist slavery or we will destroy you. And says, well, we got to declare independence. But he was not a racist. In fact, black people and white people were allowed to vote in Rhodesia. But, you know, there's also this factor, and it was true in Rhodesia, and it was true in South Africa, and it's true of the American people as well. There's this ridiculous idea that's, I think, really prevalent in our society today, that when Dutch immigrants arrived in South Africa, that when British and other European immigrants arrived in America, or when British arrived in Rhodesia, that they should have just set up a quote-unquote democracy, and set aside for now the fact that our founding fathers thought democracy was a terrible form of government, but that we should have just set up a democracy with the peoples that were found there. It's self-evidently ridiculous if you think about it. These are two cultures that are completely different in every respect. You know, what they found in South Africa, they didn't have a wheel. They didn't have a two-story building. They were worshiping ancestors. Some of them were engaged in cannibalism. They were sacrificing
pagan
people.
Pagan rituals and
precisely.
So forth. Yeah.
And to try to have a democracy with a culture like that.
And reform Christians
right,
from
Calvinist Christians from exactly. Holland who, you know, were going to operas. I mean, it's just inconceivable. It's ludicrous. It'd be like, you know, setting up a colony at Plymouth and, hey, let's have a democracy with the Cherokees, right? No, right? They're completely different societies, completely different cultures, and you can't just have a democracy, have a unitary state over them. And that's what's happened in South Africa today. And, you know, it's when you stop and think about it, it's obviously ridiculous, but people don't stop and think about it.
So one last question. You've seen what's happened in South Africa. You've written about it for over 10 years.
I lived there, yeah.
And you have lived in South Africa. So what warning would you give to the American people with regards to Black Lives Matter and everything that we see unfolding in the United States? What would you tell the American people right now?
There are direct links between the two. In fact, the Nelson Mandela Foundation really just recently encouraged Black Lives Matter in America to use violence to achieve their political goals like the South African communists did in South Africa. There's even the same spirituality behind it, believe it or not, this pagan witchcraft that we've talked about.
You've written about this in the New American.
I have, yep. And you know, they're literally talking about how they're summoning spirits, they're summoning ancestor spirits that are working through them. So, I mean, it's the same pagan, communist, hybrid monster.
And the same violent tactics of Mandela, the necklacing, yep. And all these tactics to silence the white majority into accepting communist oppression.
And it's all based on lies.
That happened in South Africa is happening right now in the United States.
That's right. And it's all based on lies. It has nothing to do with protecting black lives. If they were interested in black lives, they'd be protesting outside of Planned Parenthood, right? It's absolutely ludicrous. And the same was true in South Africa. You know, they don't talk about anymore the black opponents of communism, the Zulus, for example, who fought so hard. And there's countless black Americans who love our system. So it's a disgrace what's happening. We must resist.
Thank you so much. Thank you, and God bless.
Thanks.
You heard Alex Newman. We must resist the same fate of South Africa and Rhodesia here in the United States. Both education and organization are key to exposing and stopping the same tactics used in South Africa from metastasizing here in America. To learn more about what's been happening in South Africa, we recommend that you purchase and download the PDF copy of the November 5th, 2012 issue of the New American Magazine with the lead cover story, Genocide and Communism Threaten South Africa, by today's guest, Alex Newman. And if you have not done so, consider membership in the John Birch Society. Until next week, God bless.